Really good to see everybody here this morning. Brian has the mic turned up for Rick Moore's sake. It is a beautiful day today. I know that a lot of our members are sick. Rebecca is sick this morning also. I don't think it's too serious, but it's always good to keep all of our members in mind and in our prayers, no matter what they're facing in the serious and the mundane. Have your Bibles open to 1 Timothy chapter 3. That's where we're going to begin today in just a few moments here. It's actually the same place that Alan started his last lesson last Sunday. So I thought I would go ahead and piggyback off what he said last Sunday and take a phrase from this passage in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and talk about it in a little bit more detail. Before we get there, I want to read just a few words from the song that we just sang a few moments ago, which is very apropos for what we're going to be talking about today. In verse 2 of Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee, it says, "All thy works with joy surround thee, earth and heaven reflect thy rays, stars and angels sing around thee, center of unbroken praise." It is that center of unbroken praise that I want to talk about at this time today. It is the glory of the sun. It is the joy that we experience as we are bathed in His light. It says in 1 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 14, "I am writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I am delayed, I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. And by common confession, great is the mystery of godliness. He who was revealed in the flesh was vindicated in the spirit, beheld by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, taken up in glory." Now this phrase, "beheld by angels," is of particular interest to me today. Now, there's a reason why their witness is so valuable, their testimony, because they can testify about Jesus from both ends of the spectrum, from the utmost in the divine to the lowest of mankind. And, you know, that's what I think is really interesting about Jesus. Among many other things that are incredibly interesting about Jesus is that he wasn't just a sub-God. He wasn't one of the gods or kind of a secondary god. He wasn't an inferior god. In the sense that he was God, he was everything that it meant to be God. He was co-equal with the Father and with the Spirit in the Trinity that makes up our single Godhead. So I think it's really valuable that the angels could recognize Jesus as not just being a god or a secondary god, but he was everything that it meant to be God in the utmost, the extreme end of that spectrum. But he was also at the other extreme end of the spectrum in that he wasn't a powerful human being or a really, really tall human being. He wasn't like a Goliath or anything. He wasn't 9 feet tall. He didn't command respect from people in the sense that he had this commanding physical presence. He had no political power whatsoever. And he was born into poverty and obscurity in the most obscure place in Judea, or at least north of Judea, in Galilee. So it's like he was everything it meant to be God to the utmost on one far end of the spectrum. And he was also the lowest man that you could possibly imagine. And he didn't have to be either. He could have been anything. He could have come in any form, born under any circumstances, in any time period in human history, but he came at that time to that family under those circumstances. And the angels saw all of it. That's why their witness is so valuable, because they saw him as God in the fullness, and they saw him as a simple, humble, poor human being, a baby in a manger. A couple of things here to think about real quickly here. Angels excitedly proclaimed the birth of Jesus. They beheld him when he was born in Luke chapter 2. They ministered to him after his temptation in Matthew chapter 4, Verse 11, they beheld him in his victory over Satan. They must have been witnesses to the events of his life because Jesus claimed in Matthew 26 that they were essentially on call at a moment's notice. That at any time I could call the angels to my assistance. And when you think about somebody being on call, I think what I imagine is the firefighters that were sent from Arizona to California in the last month to assist with wildfires. Now, not all of them were actively assisting, but they were sent there so they could be on call in case they were needed. Now, do you think that as they're sitting there in a hotel room waiting to be used, you think they're not checking the news, checking their phones every 5 minutes, on call, ready to go, aware of their surroundings, aware of what's going on? The angels witnessed the events of Jesus' life, and they were ready. At any moment that Jesus asked them, they would have come, and he would never have caught them off guard or unawares. They beheld him suffering in the garden, and they came to comfort him in his distress in Luke chapter 22. They beheld his glorification in the ascension in Acts chapter 1, verses 9 through 11. And by the way, I love the attitude of the angel. That almost like, he almost just shows up where with the disciples are staring up at the sky watching Jesus ascend on a cloud. Out of nowhere, an angel just walks up and says, "Why are you, Saul? Why are you standing there with your mouths agape like that? Why are you so shocked by this?" The angels beheld Jesus at every stage of his physical life. They knew him before he was a human, and they know him now at the right hand of the Father. Truly, the angels beheld him, and that's such a marvelous phrase that Paul uses in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Their testimony means something. But another point here, beholding him in the flesh was only a spectacle to the angels at that time because they had never seen him like that before. Can you imagine what it would be like? We can't imagine, by the way. We can't, but I'm simply asking that rhetorically. But can you imagine what it would be like to know the Son as the Son at the right hand of the Father, the creative force behind all things, who created the universe itself, and I'm sure was responsible for creating spiritual beings as well, like angels. And you had always known him as the Son of God. And then he says, "I'll see you in about 33 years. I've got a mission to do." Can you imagine the angels clamoring around, trying to get one glimpse of Jesus in the flesh? What a spectacle! Now that's kind of flip-flop, isn't it, from his disciples? His disciples watched him transfigure at the Mount of Transfiguration, and they were completely in awe of that. But for the angels, that's how they'd always known Jesus. That's how they'd always known the Son. And the ascension in Acts chapter 1, his disciples are standing there, transfixed, staring at the sky, and his angels going, "Hey, you know that's what he was like for eons eternal before he was ever a human being." So it's flip-flop, wasn't it? The fact that his angels beheld him as a human being was rather astounding to them. That itself was a bit of a spectacle for them. Now let's go to the book of Revelation at this time. Start in Revelation chapter 1. And don't worry, I'm not doing a survey of the book of Revelation right now. It's kind of what it sounds like. Beginning in Revelation chapter 1, verse 1. But if you start here in Revelation chapter 1 and look at the way that the Son is presented in the book of Revelation, he's presented in various ways. And here in chapter 1, this is the description that is offered beginning in verse 12. "I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. In the middle of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to the feet, girded across his breast with a golden girdle, and his head and his hair were white like wool," notice here, "like snow, and his eyes were like a flame of fire, and his feet were like burnished bronze when it has been caused to glow in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of many waters, and in his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in its strength." Kind of calls back to your recollection the transfiguration, doesn't it? In Matthew chapter 17. They got to see a little glimpse of that. They got to see a glimpse of that at the Transfiguration. And now they get to see it in its fullness. At least John does. And he's overwhelmed by it. He doesn't even know what to do with this image. He just falls on his face like a dead man after seeing Jesus glorified like this. And of course, what's the son's response? Don't be afraid of me. I'm not here to destroy you. Get up. Don't be afraid. What words of comfort. And like so many of us, I think John struggled to make the connection between the simple, humble man that he knew in his life to the magnificent, glowing being that was presented to him at this point. There was a disconnect there that was really hard to overcome. Go to Revelation chapter 5 now. And I want to spend some time here noticing the shock and the surprise at what John finds in the next image of the Son. So in Revelation 5 and verse 1, there's a great book that was written inside and on the back, but it was sealed up with seven seals. And John knows that whatever is written in the book must be important. It must be something of inestimable value. So when he finds out that the book cannot be opened by anybody, he begins to cry. He wants to know what's in the book so badly that whatever is in there must be so valuable that he's crying. He's in tears over it. It says in verse 4, I began to weep greatly because no one was found worthy to open the book or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals. Now he's going to turn around thinking he'll see the great lion of the tribe of Judah. That's what he's expecting, isn't he? Don't worry, the lion from the tribe of Judah is going to come and open the book. He's got it all taken care of. And John feels like he's going to turn around and see that lion. And what does he actually find when he turns around? He says, a lamb standing as if slain. Now think about that. A lamb standing as if slain. In other words, a sheep carcass. He turns around, and instead of seeing the lion of the tribe of Judah, which comes with its own imagery, right? You expect to see something powerful, something mighty, something glorious, something strong, at the very least, something alive. And he turns around to see a dead sheep standing there. What a shock. What a shock. That's that disconnect that he has to overcome. And yet for the angels, getting back to our point, the overall point I'm trying to make about beholding the glory of Jesus by the angels, are the angels shocked by that? Do the angels look at the lamb standing as if slain and go, boy, he's kind of a letdown, isn't he? He's a little bit of a letdown. No, you move forward a few verses in verse 9, it says, and they sang a new song saying, worthy art thou, worthy art thou. We didn't need him to look like a lion because we know he's a lion. Whether he looks like a lion or looks like a dead sheep, he is a lion at his core. It's the heart of a lion, the power of a lion, the authority of the lion of the tribe of Judah. And worthy art thou to take the book, to break its seals, for thou wast slain. And for them, for the angels, the fact that he's slain is not a knock on Jesus. In fact, it was in his slaying that made him worthy. The fact that he was slain was the thing that they're glorifying. You're worthy because you were slain. That's not a knock on you. That's not detrimental to your authority or your power or your ability. The fact that you were slain actually gives you the authority, the credibility to break the seals. For thou wast slain and didst purchase for God with thy blood men from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Thou hast made them to be a kingdom and priests to our God, and they'll reign upon the earth. Furthermore, in verse 11, myriads of myriads and thousands upon thousands of angels were singing, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches, wisdom and might and honor and glory. Glory and blessing. There's that word glory again. How do we get to the point of seeing Christ's glory? Because many people will acknowledge that he was a historical figure, that somebody named Jesus of Nazareth did exist. They'll concede that. There are a few secular references to him. Tacitus is one in particular that I can think of. Josephus as well. There are a few references to Jesus of Nazareth. So, they'll concede that. Other people will concede, well, I don't know if he was a historical figure, but he certainly makes an interesting literary figure. And they'll concede that Jesus, whether he was real or not, had some interesting things to say. Some great sayings, things to live by, words of wisdom. But that's not acknowledging his glory. None of that is acknowledging his glory. And until you're willing to see in the slain lamb, in the human being Jesus, the fullness of deity, until you're willing to see the connection between those things, you have not yet beheld his glory and given him full acknowledgement for exactly who he is. Not was, but is. So a great passage, I believe, that helps us with this is 2 Corinthians. If we want to behold the glory and see how it changes us and see how it affects us, 2 Corinthians chapter 3 is a great place to start. Now notice here beginning in verse 12. And by the way, I know you see here through chapter 4. We'll pick up in chapter 4 in a few minutes. I want to read a few things out of chapter 3 first. And then we'll break and make a couple of comments. Then we'll get back to chapter 4 in just a little while. He says here in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 12. Having therefore such a hope, we use great boldness in our speech, and are not as Moses, who used to put a veil over his face, that the sons of Israel might not look intently at the end of what was fading away. Now, if you're not familiar with that story, if you go back to Exodus chapter 34, when Moses was in the presence of God receiving the commandments from him, he would leave the presence of God. He would come down from the mountain and his face would be glowing white, so glowing white that it was either disturbing or difficult or impossible to look at from the Israelites' perspective. So he would put a veil over his face until the glory, the brightness, would fade from his skin. Think about that. You know, we're not talking, by the way, this isn't some myth or a legend. This isn't just fiction. A human being in the presence of God literally glows with God's glory when he walks away. The skin literally glows a brightness, a residual brightness from God's glory. And Moses didn't want to disturb the Israelites in whatever way they were disturbed, so you put the veil over his face. There's another story back in, I believe it's Exodus chapter 17, where the people of Israel actually begged Moses, can you make God stop doing that thing at the top of the mountain? That whole trumpets and loud noises and the voice of thunder, he's terrifying us. Can you please make him stop doing that? So we know that the Israelites wanted to keep God's glory at arm's length. His glory scared them. It overwhelmed them. So for their sake, Moses would put that veil over his glorified, shining face until it would fade away. So that's what that story is. So pick up here back in 2 Corinthians in verse 13 of chapter 3. But their minds were hardened. I think that, you know, put the blame where it is. God's glory is not the problem. Think about that. If we have a problem with God's glory, it is not the problem with God's glory. The problem is with us. Their minds were hardened, for until this very day at the reading of the Old Covenant, the veil remains unlifted because it is only removed in Christ. But to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their heart. But whenever a man turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Think about this, that we live our lives with a veil over our face. And I believe that veil is materialism, that veil is carnalism, that veil is always thinking in terms of earthly accomplishments and earthly achievements. We think of glory from a certain perspective, and it is a very earthly perspective from which we're viewing it. We see glory as things like graduating college and getting a great job and making money. We see glory as the Grand Canyon. We see glory as winning the Super Bowl. We see glory in very earthly terms. That's a veil that's been put over our face so that we can't recognize what is true glory. But when people turn to the Lord, the veil is removed and they're finally able to recognize true glory. Glory for what it actually is. Glory esteemed as glory. Let's make a couple comments here about the veiled face. Remember that a hard heart or a hardened mind, as the text says, makes it impossible to see Jesus' glory. It was Exodus 20, by the way, I'm sorry, not in Exodus chapter 17, but in Exodus 20, verse 19 there, where the people wanted to keep God's glory at arm's length. Whenever a man turns to the Lord, what a wonderful phrase that is, that in order to have the veil of ignorance removed and to see glory for what it is, we have to submit. We have to make that first move, don't we? Now, in one sense, God made the first move in that He offered Jesus before we ever did anything. In Romans chapter 5, it talks about the way that while we were still sinners, while we were unworthy, while we did not deserve it, Christ died for the ungodly. So yes, God did make the first move in that sense. But in the sense of the change that has to happen to us on an individual basis, of you actually becoming a Christian, you'll never become a Christian until you show a willingness to submit to God. Until you're willing to submit to His will, there's nothing God can do for you. He made the offering. He made the offering, and He made the way possible, and He provided all the information that we need to make a decision and act upon it. But if you're not willing to act, that's it. You've reached a dead end. The veil lies over your heart. You choose to remove the veil. You choose to remove ideas and attitudes and habits that feel deceptively comfortable to you. You choose to stop looking at things from an earthly perspective and start seeing them from a spiritual perspective. Now, it's very easy to dismiss Jesus. And for a lot of people, it's very convenient to dismiss Jesus, to simply call Him nothing but an interesting historical human being, a historical figure, that He's informative, perhaps. He's educational. He gives us a glimpse into the messianic expectations of first century Judeans, perhaps. But that's all. And that's all they'll concede. And they don't see the glory. The Pharisees dismissed Him. The Pharisees believed He was an uneducated Galilean. In fact, that was exactly what they said about Him in John chapter 7, verse 15. Or in John chapter 8, at several points in that chapter. They rejected Jesus outright. Jesus' own relatives rejected Him in Mark chapter 6. They wondered, how can Joseph and Mary's son possibly be the Messiah? We've known Him since He was a little baby. I knew Jesus back when He was yay high. I don't believe it that He's the Messiah. They couldn't get over it because all they saw was a human being in front of them. Joseph and Mary's son. He was dismissed by people. They had the veil over their face and they couldn't recognize His glory. And as Jesus put it in Matthew chapter 13, seeing they do not see. Kind of like a stereogram. How many of you are able to see the Magic Eye posters or stereograms? I'm just curious. Show of hands. How many of you are able to do the trick to be able to see what the stereogram is? Okay, that's most people. All right. So I'm going to leave this up here for a minute. And if Brian's in control of the screen here, leave this up for our internet people who might be watching this on the internet. Leave this up here for a minute so they have a chance to look at it on the internet as well. And I'm going to tell you what it is, by the way. So you can come up to me afterward once you've figured out what's inside the stereogram and you can tell me what was on there. And don't say, oh, lots of colors. No, there's something there, something right in the middle. Now, seeing they do not see. Seeing they do not see. The people of Jesus' time, just as much as the people of our time, they see Jesus of Nazareth. They see Him, but they don't really see Him. They see Him with their eyes, but they don't comprehend Him with their minds. They see a flesh and blood human being, if that at all, but they don't behold His glory. That's what we want. We want to behold the glory. We want to be as the angels. The angels who'd see Jesus from all ends of the spectrum, who recognize Him, that He came as a human being so that He could die on a cross, but that that is not all that makes up who Jesus is. That He is the glorified Son of God. He was deity in bodily form and is now at the right hand of the Father, reigning as Lord of lords and King of kings. And all the earth is just a footstool beneath His feet. I want to behold the glory. I don't just want to see Jesus. I want to behold His glory. And I want to see that glory change me. Going back to 2 Corinthians, I know that's a typo there. We want to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Go back to the chapter we were reading earlier and look at verse 18. But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed in the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord the Spirit. What I love about this is that it shows that the glory changes us. We're beholding glory, and it is transforming us in some way. Glory is supposed to change us. And at some point, we have to make up our minds and decide to see Jesus for what He really is. When I went to the Grand Canyon the first time, I was an adult. And I know I must have been deprived as a child because we never took that road trip that you're supposed to take when you're a kid to go see the Grand Canyon and drive on Route 66. We didn't do that when we were kids. I was an adult. It was about a couple years after I had married Rebecca. Sterling was already born. He was just a little baby. And I'd never seen the Grand Canyon. We did all that driving. You know, it was like 5 hours of driving. And I kept wondering, oh, this better be worth it. All this driving, we're going up to see a big hole in the ground. And then you get there. And you step out onto that ledge and you go, okay, I get it. You win, Grand Canyon. I get it. And you see the Grand Canyon and you just don't want to leave. You just want to soak it in. Just soak it all in. Now, Sterling, as a little baby, did not appreciate the Grand Canyon. It was cold and breezy and he was crying the whole time. Now, we took our kids up there last year. We went to the north rim of the Grand Canyon with all of our kids. And, you know, they were old enough that they went out to the edge. They were holding on to the handrail, and they looked so, wow! Can we go buy a stuffed animal in the gift shop? That, you know, they were old enough to go, wow, for about 5 seconds, and then they were done. Like, okay, I've seen enough of the Grand Canyon. They saw it, but they weren't beholding the glory. Now, here's the point I'm getting at. As you mature, as you grow up, you are better able to recognize glory as glory. The difference between a 30-year-old looking at the Grand Canyon and a 3-year-old looking at the Grand Canyon is a matter of maturity and perspective. It's age. As you mature, you're better able to recognize glory. But here's the crazy thing about it. And maybe this is a paradox or something like that, or circular reasoning. But I just think God's glory sometimes makes our minds spin this way. Yes, as you mature, you're better able to recognize glory. But when you see that glory, it actually makes you more mature, which makes you recognize glory in a more mature way, which matures you, which helps you see the glory in a more mature way, which matures you. Here's what I mean about all of this is, I went to the Grand Canyon as a 30-something adult, and in my maturity, I appreciated it. But I walked away from the Grand Canyon a changed person. I walked away from the Grand Canyon a more mature person. I went into it mature, but the glory of the Grand Canyon actually had an effect on me that it matured me more. And I know it's just a canyon. It's a big hole in the ground. But anybody who's seen it knows it does change you. It really does change you. Seeing your bride walk down the aisle changes you. It changes you seeing your bride walk down the aisle. Graduating high school changes you. Now, you have to mature to a point to reach that graduation. But the graduation itself, the ceremony, the process, the achievement, well, that glory affects you. It transforms you. As we grow as Christians, we're better able to see God's glory. We behold Him and all that He is. But His glory has an effect upon us. And it makes us stronger, and it makes us more mature. It changes us. The shepherds who got to see Jesus in the manger, they were changed by the glory. They were changed by what they saw. John was changed by the revelation that he saw. You don't see what he saw and write it all down and walk away an unchanged man. And remember, John, at the point that he reached or wrote the revelation, he was a 90-year-old man who had basically seen it all and was about the most mature Christian on the face of the planet. But you don't witness the revelation and walk away an unchanged man. Glory should affect us. Glory should change us. Let us behold the glory of God. And if you're not a Christian here this morning, you haven't even taken the first step. Read the gospel, listen to its words, take in its glory, and acknowledge the power and the wonder of Jesus. And as you do that, His power and His wonder will change you. You will not be left unaffected. Become a Christian this day and begin your walk with God. Whatever spiritual need you might have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.